This episode is brought to you by Levo. Simple, potent, at-home herbal infusions at the push of a button. Learn more at levooil.com and feed your enthusiasm. That's levooil.com.
This week on Meat & Three, we dive into the science behind munchies, the history of coca, the therapeutic powers of psychedelics, and mushroom-infused recipes.
One of the biggest questions we get asked a lot is, does heat degrade psilocybin?
The coca leaf was used as a sacred plant. So as a plant that could communicate human beings with gods or Mother Nature.
What you can start to appreciate here is that cannabis is activating and hijacking the system throughout the body.
Tune in to Meat & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
And I'm your co-host, Valerie Lomas.
And we're just going to dive right into today's interview. Yorm Akwaku is the host of Item 13, a fairly new podcast here on Heritage Radio Network, but with a long history prior to joining. And we're really excited to welcome her to the HRN family and to get to talk to her a little bit today. Yorm, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm excited to dive in here.
So let's start with item 13. What is the podcast? How did you wind up starting it? And what kinds of subjects do you cover?
Cool. So item 13 is a podcast that highlights the stories of African food entrepreneurs around the world. I started it about 3 years ago as an offshoot of a food media platform that I ran, Essence 13. Just because through my work with Essence 13, I just came to realize that there was not a lot of people sort of sharing the true stories of these trailblazers, as I like to call them. There's a lot of people in the African food space that are doing incredibly interesting, powerful things, I think, and don't have a platform to be able to share their stories. So I thought I would create this. And I did do it right around the time that I myself was getting into podcasts. And so one of the podcasts I listened to quite a bit was How I Built This. And I thought, oh, this is cool. If we could have a version of this for the African food entrepreneurs that I tend to work with or engage with, that would be awesome. And so that was the root of item 13. And because people ask me this a lot, I'm going to answer it now. Item 13 is slang for Ghanaian food or snacks. And it originates from when we were colonized by the British. This is a story my parents, grandparents told me, so take it as you will. But they said that back in the day, the 13th item on a meeting agenda was always used to be food. And so people would just say, you know, if they're going to a meeting or an event or a party or whatever, they would be like, oh, is there going to be item 13, meaning is there going to be food, a good food, you know, at this event, etc. So that's why I call my podcast item 13.
Has that term continued? Do people still use it?
Yeah, to today. If I went to Ghana, if you were in Ghana today and you asked about item 13, for sure.
Get a nice plate of snacks or something?
Yeah, all food. It's just a reference to food in general. So if you just, you know, like we're going to hang out at someone's place or we're going to a wedding. A wedding, clearly there's going to be food. But if you're going to hang out at someone's and you just say, will there be item 13? They'll know what you mean by that.
All right. Good to know. Maybe this is an obvious question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Why do African food entrepreneurs or food visionaries lack the platform that food leaders from other parts of the world have?
Oh, yeah, that's why do they lack their platform? I think, and the representation, right? You think about the size of the continent, the variety and diversity of the food that we have. I think one, it comes down to a big part of it comes down to the stereotypes that people have about the continent as a whole. And one of my pet peeves, which we can discuss later, is just the terminology of African food. So even though the tagline for my podcast is an African food podcast, that had to be wrangled out of me because I just did not like it. We did that ultimately for SEO reasons and marketing purposes. But I think just the connotation of Africa alone, I think conjures in people's minds like poverty and war and I don't know, refugee, you know, all just negative connotations, generally speaking. And so when people think about Africa, they don't think about the richness and variety of our foods because they see people dying of hunger or whatever. And so they don't connect the culture to good food, plentiful food, flavorful food. And then just in general, too, by the time, you know, an African immigrant comes here and chooses to go into the food space, they generally don't have the capital, the American, I don't know the right word, it's like sensibilities, I guess, just because they don't understand the landscape in terms of how do I market this in a way that is appealing to a wider audience. So a lot of these people will be serving their specific local communities versus thinking about how do I not change this to fit the Western or American taste, but how do I make myself accessible to a wider audience. So they don't have the capital to, you know, to put in the marketing budget, for example. A lot of these people, you know, I think about in terms of the service in the hospitality specifically, they don't have the what's the right word here? Internet savviness, I guess, to go online and, you know, share what they're doing. And so that tends to keep what they are doing in local communities versus being put out there. And then just, yeah, I think I mentioned that earlier, the connotation, like one of a guest I had a couple of weeks ago, or maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, anyway, out of London was saying how, you know, when she first started her supper clubs, as they call them in England, or, you know, we would call them pop-ups here in the US, She was doing Somali food, right? And when you think about Somalia, again, you think about poverty and the war and all of that stuff. And she said, you know, a patron had the gall to ask if the food that was being served at the pop-up was clean. And so if in 2020 or, you know, 2019, you're being asked that question, even after there's a certain surge in interest in African food, West African food, if you still have people asking questions like that, there's a problem around perception for sure.
That's a really kind of loaded question. Because when we think about clean food, and this has actually been kind of the subject of controversy before with ethnic cuisines, kind of actually being gentrified. Like there was a Chinese restaurant and it was being called, well, this is clean Chinese food. This is clean eating. But I think what you're referring to is even a little more, a little more concerning. It sounds like they're referring to the actual cleanliness of the food that's being served. Correct. So, I think that's really loaded, but I think you also made a great point about, yes, you know, in the past year or two, it feels like African cuisine is trendy and, you know, specifically beyond East African, because I think Ethiopian food has kind of had its place here and popularity here. But, you know, we see like Fonio and, you know, we see a number of West African food products that are gaining popularity. But I think you just made a great point about it's kind of a little more competitive than other cultural cuisines because generally people don't refer to Asian cuisine or European cuisine. They refer to Japanese or Chinese or French or Italian. And it just feels like it kind of makes it even that much more crowded within the African food space because we're not referring specifically to Ghanaian cuisine or, you know, or West in, oh, sorry, I'm, what was I was saying, sorry, we're not referring specifically to Senegalese cuisine or Guinean cuisine. We're just calling it African food and African cuisine.
Yeah, that grates me quite a bit. And I've had this debate with others, like in the general African, truly African food space, about, you know, the back end. So I think we progressed a little bit to making it regional now so that people have a sense. And now we talk a little bit more about West African food or East African food or North African food. It's a balance between trying to help people identify the foods, because again, the education is not there. People don't know. So if I say I'm going to have nyama choma today, people are like, what? Oh, you know, I'm going to have chakalaka. Like, you know, what is that? You know, and so if I say South African or Southern African food, at least in this short term period and medium term period, it gives people context. But we want to get to the point where I can say, you know, South African food or Eritrean food without having to go into depth. And again, I understand, like, the continent is huge. There's so many countries. People are not as familiar just because they are very removed from it. But at the very least, there are, I would say, 5 or 10 like major countries that are represented consistently in the Western context that at the very minimum people should have a sense of. If today in 2020 you're in the food world, especially in food media, and that's a whole other conversation, you're in food media and you cannot distinguish between like Senegalese food and Moroccan food, then I mean, I'll give you a pass if you know you don't know Eritrean food or you don't know the food from Chad or Mali, but there's just certain basics at this point that I think people should be aware of. People that should be aware of should be aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. And for the most part, they aren't. And I also wanted to sort of take that line of questioning one step further. I mean, it's no secret that the national borders on the continent are fairly recent and fairly arbitrary, or at the very least determined by colonial powers. And that there's a huge amount of diversity within each sort of nation state as it exists today. And different ethnic groups, different people from different backgrounds will have different recipes. So I don't know, to what extent do you feel like a system of national cuisines is important in talking about African food, or should we be approaching it differently? Should we be thinking about cuisines from the continent as more specifically associated with certain ethnicities or tribal groups, or just another system beyond nationality?
I think ethnicity is probably the most appropriate way, for lack of a better term, to refer to the food. Because when you think about Fonio, for example, that Val mentioned earlier, it's not specifically Senegalese or Sierra Leonean. It's across the West African, a specific West African belt, right? And so I don't know how to say this delicately. I think the country reference is used because there isn't that education yet or understanding yet, at least in the American context, of what that means. Yeah. And so, you know, someone like Chef Pierre has to say, you know, Guinea and Sierra Leone when he refers to Fonio, for example, just because he does talk about that belt sometimes in his speeches, but then, at least from my observation, when he talks about it, he tends to have a map in the back, and it, you know, so then you can see and reference. But I think in the short term, and then just back to what I was saying about, you know, African food and why that is used more often than not, it's just because that's the point of reference that people have today. How do we move them forward? I think it starts with that regional conversation, right? So now, you know, I see a lot more now in articles and stuff, people say West African food. I think the conversation towards regional foods is great, but ultimately the best way to reference it is through the different ethnic groups that you'll find on the continent. And one of, I actually interviewed someone in this past season who was absolutely fantastic. And he's Zimbabwean, but based in South Africa, and is doing amazing work around educating people on our African foods using ice cream as a tool. So he does a lot of different African fruits and flavors and spices, and uses them in ice cream and uses that ice cream as a tool to educate people through events and whatnot. And one of the questions I asked him when he was on the podcast was to talk about Zimbabwean food in general. And he shot me down, like, not in a bad way, but he shot me down and said, there's no such thing as Zimbabwean food. You can tell me about Shona food, which is a tribe, it's a Southern African tribe, so they're not just found in Zimbabwe. But that also got me thinking, right? But it's tough. Like, I don't know. And the reason I keep coming back to the American context is not just because I think America is the end all be all, but one of the things that is important to me is creating a marketplace where people can earn like an economic, or in terms of like economic well-being for farmers, producers, and even like spice makers, people who make sauces, etc., on the continent, to be able to access markets in the West to improve their economic well-being. And so to do that, they need to be able to speak the language of the markets they're trying to access. And so it's a double-edged sword in that you're trying to, one, be authentic to who you are, but two, in, you know, creating space for people to be able to experience your culture through your food. Because I think once people experience food, and I'm sure you've had this conversation with several people, I think food is such a powerful medium to break down stereotypes and misconceptions about peoples and places. And for me, I think particularly for Africa, I think that's what's going to help do that. And so as people are trying to get, you know, their products into the American, European marketplaces, it's that, how do they construct that narrative that helps people understand where they're coming from without losing themselves in it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely challenging. I mean, it's challenging from, I mean, this is what I do for a living, right? Is work with farmers to get them to get their products to market here in the US. And it's challenging in every context for a producer, you know, whether they're a farmer or even a small company that's trying to figure this out. If they don't know their market, and as you mentioned, their market doesn't know them, it's very difficult to figure out how to sell something, how to market that product. Right. So I don't know, what have you seen, or have you seen projects that you think have been successful in that area, or how do you recommend
it? I have. So I mean, I don't want to go. Chef Pierre is an example that's used consistently over and over again, but I think he's done a wonderful job of creating that context. And so for him, I think, one, he frames Fonio around the concept of health first. And so thinking about people who are trying to eat healthier, more like nutrients-dense foods, and then gluten-free, you know, people who have intolerance to gluten, for example, and then also ties their story back to what he's trying to do back at home in terms of helping the farmers there, the women who have to do all the work when Fonio is harvested, trying to create a marketplace for them in the U.S. So I think he really truly threads this, connects all the dots that makes the Fonio story really compelling. So he's a good example.
And that's Pierre Thiam, and his company is Yolele Foods.
Yes, Yolele Foods. And then they have Teranga, which is a cafe, I guess you'd call it that, up in Harlem. And then I think they're opening a space in Brooklyn too as well. Yeah. So he's a pretty good example. I use Celeste as an example all the time, so maybe I will not use her this time. I'm trying to think of somebody else. The Gingin brothers, too. I guess we're New York based, so let's talk New York. The Gingin brothers are also a great example. So there are two brothers from Sierra Leone who make this ginger drink. And they've done a great job in terms of branding and telling this, you know, their story through their product. And they also now have a coffee shop / cafe up in Harlem, where they not only sell their ginger drinks, but you know, they do coffee, hot chocolate, and then and snacks and whatnot. And they were also a group I had on the podcast talking about their journey to get where they are, and some of the stories they shared both online and offline about, you know, fundraising and some of the things that were told to them to their face about being an African CPG company. again, to me, like in 2018, 2019, 2020, to be able to hear that. I mean, I give kudos to them because, and everybody, I'm promoting them. Go check them out. They're online. They're shipping their drinks anywhere in the continental U.S. But to be able to face that and still go on knowing, you know, they have a true north. And so for that, that's good for them. I think that they're forging ahead in terms of, in spite of the challenges they face. And so I hear the stories of these people that are doing amazing things that have shaped their narrative towards the Western gaze, if you will, but have still, you know, maintained their authenticity. They still have issues around prejudice and discrimination and misconceptions about like African food. So those two are great examples, I think. Just their branding, their storytelling, it's really great. They still face challenges around misconceptions and whatnot, but there are a couple of people that I'm proud to have associated with the African food brand, quote unquote.
Yeah. Yeah, we had Raheem from Jinjin on the podcast. What was it, Valerie? Like probably a year ago now, at least.
I think it was in February, like right at the end of the four times.
Shows you how specific my understanding of time is these days.
Right. It was right before the world shut down and we were still recording in the studio. So, you know, I encourage people to head to our archives and check out our interview with Raheem Jallo for another perspective about, someone who is building from the ground up an enterprise with a focus on, selling this drink that was based off of their childhood growing up in West Africa. So,
yeah, let's take a quick break. Stick with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
This episode is brought to you by Levo, the world's most intelligent at-home infuser. It's super easy to use to make infusions for cooking, candies, cosmetics, and herbal medicines. When the box showed up, I was excited to try it out as I've heard good things about the machine. It looks like a space-age coffee maker on the counter, and having it out makes me want to infuse everything. I've got plans for the hot peppers on my counter and the sage I picked from the garden before the first freeze last week, along with some other choice herbs and spices. I think everyone on my list is going to get infused oils this year. So far, I've used it for cannabis, basil, and orange peel infused oils and butter. The machine even has dry and activate functions for the highest potency and stability in your infusions, and you can connect through Wi-Fi to track your progress and record your recipes and share with the Levo community. Learn more at levooil.com. That's levooil.com.
And we're back. Our guest this week is Yoram Akwaku, host of the Item 13 podcast here on Heritage Radio Network. Yoram, you took sort of a circuitous path to your current role. You started off your career as an accountant. How did you make the switch? And what was it about food that brought you to this place?
Good question. So yes, I started out as an accountant. So I moved to the U.S. at 18 or 19, I never remember, for college, studied accounting. And I thought I was going to be a partner at the firm that I worked at. I loved my job coming out of school. It was great. I learned a lot. It was very fast-paced. I liked that very much. But towards the end of my time there was when the recession hit. So 2007, 2008. No, I take that back. Yeah, 2007, 2008 was when I started my career. And then just the effects of the recession started to sort of impact the work my team was doing. And so there were a lot of people laid off. And quote unquote, they said the star team remained. So my team went from 20 to 5. I was one of 5 left standing. But that also meant the workload was just incredibly ridiculous. I was working, I don't know how many hours a week traveling because my work involved a lot of travel. And I just couldn't do it anymore. So I transitioned out of that, went to work in industry for a little bit, and then decided to get my MBA because I was seriously then thinking about moving back home, but wanted to get my master's before doing that. But then when I got my MBA, the reality of student loans hit me then. And so decided to stay. But I knew then also that I did not want to work in the US. So post MBA, I got a job for a big global bank. And my job took me around the world. So for the last 5 years, or for the 5 years I was with a bank, I worked, let's try to do this count. I worked in New York, Frankfurt, London, Dubai, Johannesburg, Toronto. So those five or six cities. It was a great experience. I think my job was made easier just by the anticipation of moving and living and working abroad. But it was, to your question, it was in those 5 years of living and working abroad that the reality of the low representation of African food around the world hit me. So when I lived in Frankfurt in particular, Frankfurt was the most lonely place for me personally in terms of all the places that I lived at. And I just won. It was very hard to find African ingredients to cook with. And so I would use basic stuff. Like there's stuff like you can do with peanut butter, for example, you can find it in any store. So I would make peanut butter stew or whatever, but then it becomes repetitive, right? And so it was during my time in Frankfurt, really, that I started to think about that African food representation. One, just from my personal experience, and then two, with working with clients and then just co-workers, there was you'd go to dinner and then people would ask, you know, what do you guys eat? What is African, again, which greeted me, what is African food? And then I would talk specifically about Ghanaian food and what we would have back home. But then I realized that even for highly educated people that should have somewhat of a worldview, that they knew absolutely nothing about African food. And so I started to create content around the food that I could make, at least in my kitchen. And this content really was just for my growing circle of friends that I had in Frankfurt and then as I moved around the world. As I created content, I started to discover other people who were doing it and doing it much better than I was. So I sort of switched from focusing on, you know, sharing what I was doing in my kitchen to really highlighting the work that other people were doing. I guess back then, like the Instagram algorithm wasn't as, you know, restrictive as it is now, because that grew very, very quickly. And as it grew and as I got to learn more from the entrepreneurs I was showcasing, I realized the need for things like, you know, I think I mentioned this at the top of the podcast, things like business skills that they didn't have. They didn't know how to position themselves in the marketplace. They didn't understand even just like basic social media skills in terms of putting their stuff out there. And so I started to create programming and events that would support them in those spaces. So I did things like we did a hackathon, which was really cool back in Accra. That was probably my favorite thing ever. We did a hackathon. We've done food pitch competitions to help them get money. One, get money for their businesses, but also help them think about, you know, what is their voice in terms of their brand voice, their personal voice. What is their story that they're trying to tell the world? So those pitch competitions were great for that. We did in London, did a couple of business workshops. So we had people come in and talk to them about PR for your business, marketing for your business. What was the other one? It was the third one. I can't remember off of the top of my head. And then it was also through this process then that the podcast was born, because, again, I found that really just from my interaction with all these people, wanting to be able to share their stories on a platform that would get it outside of the rooms. Well, back in the day when we could hang out in groups. And I guess that is the plus side of when you think about it now, I'm switching gears now, but when you think about, you know, the world we're in today in terms of COVID, I think the explosion of virtual events and just having people being able to get their message, their stories, their brands, their products, services to an audience that they otherwise wouldn't have gotten to or even thought about it's fantastic. And so, you know, we did this stuff in small groups of 30 people or 50 people, or maybe in the case of the hackathon, probably 150, 200 people. But now with growing interest and like people's comfort with virtual events, I could see that being a real plus for some of these businesses, you know, if they are, you kind of need to have to be strategic about it. But yeah, I think I said more than you expected me to, but that is how.
No, it's a great story.
That is how I ended up in the food world, and that's what I've been doing since.
Yeah. It's a great story, and I think we won't get into it today, but if anybody is interested in learning more specifically about Ghanaian food or West African food more broadly, our guest last week was Zoe Ajonyo, who's the British Ghanaian chef, and we talked quite a bit about West African and Ghanaian flavors and textures and sort of, I don't know, key points from the cuisine. So I encourage everybody to listen to last week's interview.
Yeah, Zoe used to have a place in Brixton. I don't know if she mentioned that.
Yeah.
Zoe's Ghana Kitchen, which is really cool, actually a cool spot, yeah. In some container container yard in Brixton in London, which is cool.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there has been a little bit more of a awareness in the U.S. or in the non-African world about African cuisine, or I should say, an increased awareness over the last 10 years, maybe, and I think social media plays a big role in that. I mean, Nigeria being the population powerhouse of the continent,
right.
with huge numbers of people on social media and talking about everything, including food. I guess my question is, what are some of the ways the key ways that you've seen these perceptions of African foods change recently, and where do you think that's going? What's next for the Western perception of African foods?
The Western perception of African food. So that's a really good question. I think for me, not to go back to Shapir again, but I think it's the positioning, right? So I think each business, each entrepreneur has to think about, how do I want to position myself with this rising tide? And so I think you need to think about what your strengths are, because there's different ways to approach it. I think there's the health aspect of it, which I think is really important, especially now as more and more people think about nutrition, food as medicine, as they call it, as a growing wave. Ethiopian food in particular, as you know, Val mentioned earlier, has been popular always, but I think the option that it gives for vegan, vegetarian people has also helped sort of with its popularity. And so thinking about where you can fit in that space. When I talk to entrepreneurs, I tell them to focus on things like the health benefits, things like flavor. I think even spiciness, because I think there's also a misconception that especially West African food can be very spicy. And so the Western palate is not inclined to try it because of, you know, that misconception. But again, back to this idea of tribe versus country, even versus region, even within Ghana, when I think about our foods, they're not necessarily spicy to the point of like, I'm going to fall over and die here. It's really a matter of taste. So we have specific spices that, you know, we'll use for different types of foods, but it really comes down to the family unit and why people, you know, grew up a certain way or chose to eat a certain way because their grandma did it this way, and so that's why they eat it. But I wouldn't put a general broad stroke that our food is spicy. And so to answer your question, I think it's really about how we position ourselves. So I think if we focus on the health aspects of our food, like a lot of our foods, especially if I focus on West African food in particular, a lot of it is naturally vegan, naturally gluten-free, complex carbohydrates. So if you're thinking about eating better, but also, you know, as the new year is coming around and people will start to make resolutions that they'll break by February, at least if you're trying to eat healthy food and you focus on West African foods, for example, that you can have without worrying about, you know, is it going to be bland because it's kale or whatever. You can have plantains, you can have tomato-based, peanut-based stews. Well, if you're not allergic, obviously. But there's different ways and dishes and spices and flavors that you can use with our foods that you can have that's healthy, that's good for you, that you don't have to compromise on flavor. So that for me is the big thing, is because there's a lot of push in the general food space around plant forward, like, you know, food that's good for you. And I think if our entrepreneurs and businesses focus on that then in terms of fitting into the Western marketplace, that could be a winning play. Because I had a guest way back, I think season one or season two, who said, you know, she was trying to lose weight for a bunch of different reasons. And, you know, she had gone down the path of, you know, she's going to have minestrone soup and she'd been giving all of this stuff. And then she decided, she spoke to her mom, and her mom was like, you should just eat her Ghanaian food, you know, just, you know, mind your portions and all of that. And she lost so much weight within a short period of time, just eating stuff that she loved, right? So like she had plantain, she had yam, she had fufu, she had everything that, you know, she didn't feel like she was restricting herself in any way. So she felt good, her food tasted good. So her story always sticks with me when I think about, you know, a lot of people that are trying to combat chronic diseases through diet. I think about the role that African food can play in that space, for sure.
And I mean, maybe this has been over-told, but there's also obviously strong connections between Southern food in the U.S. and African ingredients and techniques. Do you think that helps? Does that give Americans a context or at least sort of familiar touch points, or should it be a different conversation entirely?
No, I think it does. I'm not sure how much it does for... I think it, in my experience, I should say, let me caveat this. In my experience, I think it does for Black Americans in particular, who are looking for ways to reconnect to the continent. So I'm finding that with my podcast, at least, and in the space that I'm in, I'm finding, to my surprise, I didn't realize that this was a thing. Like when I created the podcast, when I started my platform, it really was for people on the continent and in the diaspora to sort of reconnect with our food, our culture, gain an appreciation for it, and then also to create a platform for those in the space, you know, to have a voice for the work that they are doing. What I found over the years, though, is that there has been an increasing interest from the African-American, a lot of African-American women in particular, I don't know why it's women specifically, who are interested in connecting back to their roots. I don't know if it's as a consequence of what's going on in the country and like really thinking about, you know, where else can I call home? And so thinking about their African roots and ancestry, and then discovering the work that we're doing and saying, I want to learn more about, you know, African food. And I know I see the connection between West African food, for example, and stuff in the South. So I see that connection more with Black American people. And we had a guest, a Liberian guest, at the beginning of season four, who talked about the connection between, like, so, you know, Liberia has a connection with the civil rights movement, in that it was the first, you know, there's a bunch of freed slaves that essentially moved over to Liberia, formed a country, and blah, blah, blah. And so that particular episode was very, very popular, especially for that group of my audience, because it gave a clear connection to them to like why and how they're connected. And some of the foods that Dominique, who was our guest, described completely, like Liberian foods are, you know, clear lines to Southern American food. And you could see the connections, the differences and the similarities. So I've seen that more with you know, African-American, Black American populations. Not necessarily, at least in my experience anyway, like the wider American audience.
Wider or whiter or both?
Let's leave that to right, interpretation.
On that note, can we do some rapid fire?
Yeah, sure.
Do it. All right, I'll start. I kind of want to make this good. Jeez. What is an ingredient that, because you mentioned, you know, when you were in Frankfurt, you had a hard time finding a lot of ingredients that you use in your cooking. What is like your one can't live without ingredient that you can't find at like a typical supermarket here?
I would say that's a good. So this is rapid fire. So I won't get into it. Plantains, I will say, which is will be surprising to you because you're in New York, but plantains.
That is surprising.
Yeah, but it will surprise you because it's. Yeah, this is rapid fire, so I wouldn't get into it, but plantain is one surprising thing that I can get.
Get into it a little bit. Now I'm curious.
No, it depends on which part of the country you are in, right? And then two, even living in Johannesburg, like plantain, and again, this was a learning experience for me. I lived in Johannesburg for 2 years. It was so difficult to find plantains. Like I would have to call around. It would be sporadic depending on, you know, which part of the city, and then I would have to drive out to find it because plantains are not a thing of Southern Africa. And so this is, again, the thing about like conceptions about African food. And, you know, we say plantain is African. No, it's not. It's unique to parts of Western Africa and then even East Africa to an extent. But then they have bananas versus plantains. It's this whole thing, right? And so, but for me, plantain is a staple. Like it's almost like salt and pepper. I have to have it in my, you know, in my rotation of things I'm going to cook with. But it's eluded me in a lot of places, surprisingly.
What is your desert island kitchen tool? What do you take with you if you can only take one thing?
Oh, wow. I will say, and this you have to look up. I will say, It's called Asanka. It's a Ghanaian. It's a multi-purpose Ghanaian kitchen tool. So it looks like it's an earthen. It's made out of clay. It's an earthenware bowl. It's made out of clay. It's, you know, put it in an oven, comes out. It looks black, but it has all these ridges within it. So you can use it to grind stuff. You can use it as a bowl to eat within it because you grind spices and whatnot. So if I find herbs on the island or whatever, I can grind that up, you know, put a little seawater into it and make a little bit of something. And then I have a bowl to eat out of. So
I love the practicality. Where can our listeners find your podcast, find your work more broadly, follow you on social media?
Good question. So I'm here on Heritage Radio Network. So if you search for Item 13 Podcast on Heritage Radio, you'll find us on Instagram, which is where I'm most active with the podcast. I have our Instagram account is Item 13 Podcast. And then you'll see a link to other stuff that we're doing and working on there. So Item 13 Podcast is the best way. Google at Item 13 Podcast across social media platforms. And then on Heritage Radio.
Awesome. It was so lovely having you. You guys, as always, you can find us at Why Food Podcast on social. And you can also shoot us an email. You can find me on social at Foodie in New York, and
you can find me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram.
And also, it is Ethan's birthday today.
Oh, no.
Ooh, happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Ethan. I know he doesn't like to always share awesome things that he's up to, but is anyone making you a cake today, Ethan?
My wife got me my favorite cake from a little local bakery near us in Queens, which is, it's an Italian bakery, but in a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood. And so they do a layer of cheesecake and a layer of flan on top of the cheesecake. Ooh. And it is, spectacular.
That Letty sounds bakery
divine. In Jackson Heights.
Awesome. All right. Send us a piece virtually, okay?
Yeah, I will. Thanks to our amazing sound engineer, Amanda Wong. Thanks to the Red Crickets for our theme song, which is called Blind. And most of all, Yorm, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your expertise and experience with us and with our listeners.
Thank you. This is great.
Talk to you all next week.
Okay, bye.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage.